where you can buy for your budget. So you're going to have an idea.
Australia, come to Australia. Wait up. No, it's here, isn't it? The Australian Property Podcast. So they're going to talk about, what happened over there? Back there, I don't know. Anyway, they are talking about something about, turn it off, man. This fuck up with you. Some bloke is just dressed with a skirt. Well, he wasn't Scottish. Sub man. What do you call those people anyway? A man with teats and a dick. what I was gonna say, I got the fan going too. That we have a problem with money, we have a problem with buying, we have a problem with this, we have a problem with that. We have a lot of issues, many issues. I've seen people beautiful, and they need to be more beautiful. On the name of God, into your body. In the name of God, into your body. Well, Australia is maybe it's like everywhere else, but there's more rich people in America. More rich people somewhere else. We're spending a lot to produce, to make houses, to make this, make hotels, apartments. I don't know what I'm saying, but it's difficult to make love and have kids. And I can't explain it. I'm shaking right now. I'm shaking. I am very, very, very nervous. I don't know how to explain it. If I had it all in one, like money, markets, banks, housing, the road, the traffic, the people, the beautiful. They're all doing sporting. I don't know why I don't have a girlfriend. I don't know why I don't have a car. I don't know why I'm not going for a holiday to Chile. I don't know what I'm doing. What? I love you. Woo-hoo. Debate question. Australia.
Consultation with our broker, ideally that whole time, and we've said, okay, we're close to that goal. How do we then go and get a mortgage? How long does all of that take? Just say, you know, I want to buy a property soonish. Should I be getting a pre-approval now if I wanted to buy in 6 months? How does that all work, Chris?
Well, how long it takes to get the loan pre-approval is, you know, at the moment it's really fast. I mean, COVID times it really blew out to weeks potentially, but it shouldn't take long. The reality is banks are getting more and more digitally savvy. They're getting better at their processes and they're resourcing their team. So once you've got all your documents and you've got your payslips and you're ready to lodge a pre-approval, it doesn't take very long. But sometimes it's just about getting yourself financially ready. So, you know, sometimes when you start a business, maybe you've got to wait for different tax returns. Maybe you've got a bonus or you're on a contractor or you're getting, you know, commissions of some sort. And so sometimes you've got to wait for, you know, those things to reflect in the bank's eyes. But the whole getting pre-approval can happen really fast, and it just depends on the bank that you have to lodge with. But ultimately, I think you want to be talking to that broker, like you said, along that journey, and then the broker would say, okay, well, you're actively looking in the next 3 months. If you're actively in the market, you should have pre-approval. The amount of clients that have come to me and over the years on a weekly basis, and that's not a joke, where they have fallen in love with the property, and they want to buy and they haven't got pre-approval, or they had pre-approval but it expired. So they're actively in the market, they're looking, but they're not, you know, ready to go right now. Because the thing that we talk about next is that speed matters a lot in the property market.
Yeah, and sometimes you might come across situations where you think you're ready to go, but you're not. Maybe you've just recently changed jobs and that lender wants to see a couple of pay slips, or maybe you run your own business and you need to have a certain amount of, you know, time within that business and years of financials, all these kind of little bits and pieces which could put you back a little bit longer. But if you have been actively working with a mortgage broker and, you know, you're close to getting started, maybe just have a chat to them a little bit sooner than you think when you're really, really ready. But yes, the active, as long as you've got all your paperwork in order and you can get it all back to your broker, to get the actual pre-approval is pretty quick. That's the shortest phase in all of these four phases, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I sort of do, you know, say this with a bit of, you know, holding back. You know, I do think in that saving phase is a good time to really educate yourself on the property market and what you're looking to buy, and go to open homes and, you know, and just start to, you know, really could sit down and talk through your life plan. And, you know, the compromises you're willing to make as a single or a couple or as a family, and what matters more to you, and, you know, these type of conversations, because these can be big conversations, particularly when you're trying to catch your partner to have a big life chat. And they can take many months for you to think about it. So as you're building your savings and as you're getting ready to get pre-approved, you know, it's not the end of the world, you know, to get some of that property experience, even if you're not in the market. And so when you are ready with the finance, you're more active, you know, you're more willing to, and you've got those sort of reference points to be able to, you know, understand things much faster. I do, you know, you just got to be careful. Sometimes people then go, oh, boy, maybe I could make it happen. It's such a great opportunity to buy, and I don't want to let it go. And maybe I could make, so people go sometimes for the first property, they look for an opportunity rather than what the right property is for them, and what's a great investment, because they think it sounds like a bargain, or, and they just try to buy a property so they can enter the market. And I think that's where that danger comes. Sometimes when people are watching the market and looking.
Oh, well, some people are very specific. Some people are very, they want to in that point to where the point where the my God, it's like you walked up. I did all this. I did all that. You know what I mean? Like some people might do that. It's sad, man. That's sad. They do all you. Are you? Very sad, man. It's really sad. Like, you could be caught by the police, you could be financial, you could question that to question this.
Opportunities present themselves and they snap up and they go in the wrong direction.
Yeah, so even though we're now doing this research phase as the third phase that we're talking about, it actually really comes before the pre-approval phase. It definitely, in my opinion, should come before that, because it can take a really, really, really long time, especially for some people, to do this research. And when I'm talking about research, I'm not talking about sitting down and creating spreadsheets and trawling through CoreLogic and that kind of thing, because I, you know, I love property, and even to me that sounds not super exciting. But the research phase is really a combination of, first of all, figuring out what you want to achieve out of all of this. What's your overarching strategy? Is this a home? Is this an investment? How long are you going to live there for? What priorities do you have in your life based on the time frames that you want to live there? All of those things. So that's like personal strategy. That forms part of the research phase. It's super, super important. The research phase is also around then educating yourself on what you can buy and where you can buy for your budget. So you're going to have an idea around how much you can then spend, make a decision on whether you're comfortable with spending that based on the mortgage repayments. And then you'll say, okay, well, these are my options. Maybe I could buy an apartment closer to the city, or buy a townhouse further out, or a house further out, or an investment property interstate. You're going to be then faced or presented with a lot of different options. It might be really clear straight away if you already know what you want and where you want to live, which is great. And then I guess the third phase of that research part is, well, how do you go and buy a property? How are you going to teach yourself how to do all of this? If you don't engage a buyer's advocate, and you don't have a really close network of friends and family that can hold your hand through all of this, how are you going to learn how to do it? Because we don't really get taught this. And if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably already actively seeking information anyway. But once you get that pre-approval, ideally you have as much confidence as you can to then go out there and start looking at properties and being in a position to make offers and all of those kind of things, because sometimes a really good property does come up really quickly. And I've seen plenty of people that say, oh, it's too soon. It's too soon. I'm not ready yet. But if you had spent all of that time on your preparation and research, there is no reason why you can't buy really quickly because you've got all of that.
Okay. The other thing is, beautiful. Money this, money that. The person wants to buy to live forever, wants to buy something, doesn't want to rent, doesn't want to do any of that shit, wants to buy now. A young family, 30 years old, they want to buy, they got to buy, they need to buy, where to buy. Their families are going to teach them, everybody's going to teach them, don't be shy, don't let the cat take your tongue. There is no way to this part over here, to this part over here, to this part over here, to... You're nervous. Business or anything. My God. Money.
That empowerment behind you, and you've done all of your homework and benchmarking. And I've bought, I think the quickest time I've bought for a client is like a day. Because I knew exactly what they wanted. I found the perfect property straight away and they bought it. And for me, just for context, as a buyer's agent, my average time frame to buy a client from the day that we sign up together, bearing in mind that I do all the homework with them before I sign them up, that's really important to make a point about. My average time frame to buy for someone is 6 to 8 weeks-ish. And yes, I'm a professional, but what that suggests is you can do that too. It's not a rush, it's not a race. But if you, and what I would say is I don't even know what the average time that buyers would take to buy for themselves, but it would be way longer than that.
Would you tend to agree with me?
But if you're doing everything properly, like we do as buyer's agents, there's no reason why you couldn't buy within that time frame. Again, not a rush, but why look for any longer than you need to? Because with looking for a really, really long time, especially when it becomes like 8, 12 plus months, I promise you'll start to get fatigued and exhausted and despondent, and you'll start spending money on building inspections, and it's no fun when it gets to that time frame. It never needs to take that long, unless you're looking for something that's super, super rare, and in which case your research will tell you that anyway. You just, know that that's going to take a long time.
You took the words out of my mouth there, Amy. I think it does, go down to sometimes the scarcity of what you're looking for. And scarcity can be sometimes a catch-22, right? Sometimes people are looking for a very unique asset because it's got some features where there's only a few of those. Maybe it's a beachfront, or maybe it's like in a smaller pocket where people very rarely sell, and they really want to be in those two streets, and you've got lots of things they're not willing to compromise on. And so what you're kind of looking for is a needle in the haystack there, and sometimes you can just be waiting, and you just got to really understand the opportunity cost of that waiting. Is it okay if you buy in 12 months time if markets move 15%, or if they do move, will you still be able to afford it, and what would you do then? And thinking through that plan B, that next alternative, I think you've got to be really stress testing your brief or what you're trying to achieve with some actual sales in the last 3 months. Try not to go 6 to 12 months. Like, you kind of want to see how many properties, even just looking through the portals and, the land registry service in New South Wales, for example, has all the past sales, some that, would have been off market and things like that. And thinking through, well, how many of these realistically would we have considered based on our brief? And,
I'll tell you my benchmark for that, because I have had to come up with a number to give people when they're doing their homework. And I say on average one a month.
Yeah.
To say that it's achievable. And when I say one a month, that's a property that in theory, maybe you walked through it, or maybe you saw it sold online, but it ticks all the boxes on paper and has sold within your budget. On average, one a month. So you'd say like 6-ish over the last 6 months.
Mm.
8 would be even better. And that demonstrates a realistic and achievable brief. If you can only find one or two, that's a bit concerning, especially because you say you found one recent sale. You're like, this is the only one I can see that I could have afforded, but look, it's perfect. You don't know the background behind that sale. Maybe it sold cheap because it had a problem with it or for whatever reason, but one is not enough to give you confidence that that's recreatable. In fact, it suggests it's a very high scarcity property. So either you have to have patience, but if you have patience, like you said before, Chris, you have to then have a bit of a buffer so that if the market moves up or if that property comes up and it's competitive, you can fight for it too.
That's the thing, isn't it? There's lots of properties people would love to live in or probably been great investments, but sometimes they're out of budget. And this is just the harsh reality of entering the market at limited budgets. And, you know, this is a problem for everyone. Obviously more problem for people who aren't in the market than it is for people who've got a property, right? But ultimately, people really want what they just can't afford. You know, it's just usually above, or they don't usually go and shop in a suburb that's well within their budget. Yes, people do, but typically people don't, just because of how unaffordable things are already. And you've really got to make sure that there's multiple that are coming up, because you're right, I've seen many clients fixate on a sale and go, well, I just want to recreate that 121 Smith Street because that was everything I wanted and it was in my budget and it sold 2 months ago. So yeah. I've got a chance. And actually, you know what? 121 Smith Street, you actually didn't see the property. It had building issues, it had, you know, privacy problems that you couldn't see on the pictures. The red bedrooms were small. You didn't think about that. You know, there was issues with the DA next door. Like, there's all these. And then all of a sudden, the seller did a really quick sale because it was, you know, a family pressure, or there was a really hot auction for near down the road that everyone went to, and then this one kind of got
missed. There's so many variables.
You know,
so many variables.
And those things, you just don't know. You just see the price and the property and, and sometimes, and vice versa though, you know, sometimes people would think that, you know, oh, I can't afford anything in the market because there was one sale and it was way more than we can afford. Well, that could have just been a super, super hot auction and it just went 10%, 15%
I had one on the weekend that went at least 10, 15% higher than we not only did the comparable sales suggest, but we had a competitive buffer on that and it still went 15, 20 over. That was just two people that really, really, really wanted it, really pushed themselves. Who knows, maybe their grandma lived in the next street and they had to be there. But yes, we need a broad variety and selection of data to be able to make decisions. So the whole point of this research phase, and I get clients to do a lot of this before we start working together, because once we start working together, we need to hit the ground running as buyer's agents. So at the end of that research phase, you will have a strategy. A strategy is essentially saying, you know, like, what are my goals with this property? What are my time frames? Like, where am I buying and why am I buying it? And then also your property brief, which we have covered in other episodes. Owen and I did a full episode about how to create your property brief, which is a really, really clear written down brief of budget, locations, and then the property characteristics, your non-negotiables and your bonuses. And then you are ready. I call that like being ready to buy a property. Being ready is not about getting a pre-approval. You need that, but you also need to have done all of that homework and then be emotionally good to go, so that now you can go out there and start seriously looking at properties. And then if the right one comes up really quickly, you're ready to buy it. And if not, and if one doesn't come up straight away, well, that's fine too. You know, you've done everything you can to put yourself in that position.
Yeah, I sometimes, like you said, you had a client buy within a day. Sometimes when a client says they fall in love with a property, and it's the first weekend they've gone and looked at properties, which is quite common. I'm always like, oh, like, really? Like, and I'm, you know, and sometimes, you know, they are all great properties. And you just sort of say, hey, I think you should keep waiting. You know, I think you should, like, look at these type of properties versus these type of properties. Just send them, put their, I mean, it even happened this week, you know, they're comparing a really high density apartment to more of a boutique block. And it's just because there's not much on the market. They've kind of gone and searched new areas and things like that where they were so close to the right direction before. Sometimes there is an absolute cracker and it's 2 days after getting pre-approved and I've seen them self-sabotage and go, oh, let's just wait.
Yeah.
It's too soon. And 3-6 months later, they're still thinking about that property that they missed out on and that they could have put their furniture in and things like that. And so the only way to get that confidence to transact is you have a professional like a buyer's agent who really knows the market and can lay it out for you and say, you know what, this is a really good property and it really suits what you're telling me. Even though it's 2 days in, you really should consider it. These are the reasons why. The only way you're going to get that is with a professional that knows that market, who you really trust, or you've been in the market 12 months and you've seen everything else on the market and everything's been. And so I think that's a really good way to bypass that research phase, is that local specialist buyer's agent. But you just got to be really careful. And it's really selecting the right buyer's agent for that area, who someone who is transacting in that property, who does have good relationship with the agents, who, you know, isn't just going to say, oh yeah, it looks pretty good, and doesn't really know the quirks for the local area and things like that. And so I think that's where you get a really good buyer's agent to help you bypass a lot of that research phase, to allow you to transact faster. And that could, if that was just saved you 3 months, that would more than pay.
Oh, fuck it.
Critics said digital art was just a trend, but I'm Sarah Tafer, and I managed...
That would kind of engage them in what I was saying, but they said that money does come up often, and especially in that sort of generation now that they would be caring for at that older age.
Oh, this is the other podcast, the Australian Financial Podcast.
People that would have pursued it at the cost of other things, or prioritised it over other things, or used it in all the wrong areas, or, you know, thought about accumulating so much of it and then not ever seeing the benefit of that, or not really knowing why, or yeah, I just think it's really interesting.
Oh, that is fascinating. And something else I'd be keen to talk about more, for a lot of people, money seems like a really tedious, dry topic, and a lot of people have a lot of resistance when it comes to getting involved in their finances and taking a more active seat in the direction of their own financial journey. How would you suggest someone approach their finances if they've been the one that's like, oh, I don't really want to sort my finances out, or it's something I can sort out later?
I think money can be really fun, and I think that the easiest way to get into it is to make it fun. And for me, I feel like this is often to do with knowing your motivation style, or the way your brain works. Like, are you very motivated by rewards? Is it going to take, you know, things like challenges get a really bad rap. I know that people...
It's inspirational, writing down things like this for that, and how does it work in one full year to do all these things, to put it all together and doing it, saving the money, where, how, gotta buy a bedroom, gotta buy a townhouse, gotta finance here, finance there, help out. Less, buy less, budget.
Doing variations of 75 hard and 75 rich and stuff like that on TikTok and things like
I've
that.
I've seen that.
The 75 hard
sounds really hard.
I'm not interested in that.
Two workouts a day, Emma.
No, I'm not into that at all. But I like the, you know, 75 richer, 75 hard style, I think, is one where you don't buy clothes and you put together outfits from your existing wardrobe.
I mean, you can create any kind of challenge you want.
Anything you want, yeah. Two broke chicks are doing a 75 rich in life, or something like that they're doing. Anyway, challenges get a really bad rap, especially if they're no spend challenges, or if there's any kind of restrictive aspect to it. But if it makes it fun, go nuts. Like, if gamification works for you, do that. If community accountability works for you, get a friend, or join one of these TikTok challenges, or join another kind of container where you're going to be involved. If there's resistance to getting involved with it, you need to use some other pillar of motivational theory, I suppose, to get you engaged. So there's got to be something that's interesting to you. There's got to be a desire there. Build up on those things. There's got to be a commitment there. There's got to be a need for you to want to change. So dial up those things in some kind of way. Make it interesting, make it fun. It's almost like, I feel like I'm reciting James Clear's Atomic Habits. It makes a lot of sense. Like, make it easy, make it enjoyable to do. Give yourself a container to try something out. If you're externally motivated by rewards, put a reward at the end of that. There's a lot of research around how visualization can help you get engaged with things. So if you're like, oh, I really don't want to engage in changing my spending habits, or sorting my money out, or even looking at my bank account, how can you like bribe yourself to do that? Like, how can you visualize something that you want that you can't have because of this problem, and kind of get your brain to trade off the energy? Like, if I put a bit of energy here, then I can get this thing that I've been thinking about, whether it is, you know, a holiday or a pair of sneakers or a debt payment that you make, like whatever it is, something to reward yourself for doing the hard thing. Because we should treat ourselves like children sometimes.
Sometimes you just have to be a parent to yourself.
Exactly.
There's so much power in accountability, though, in having someone to do it with, whether it's you can just listen to a podcast and that encourages you, or whether you can find a group of people working on their finances together where you can go, well, we might not be able to find the answers on our own, but collectively we can all do a bit of research and come to the table and share our progress, share when we didn't reach our goal for the month and what went wrong, and maybe how can we adjust it or make it more realistic for the next month. I remember chatting to some people on our roadshow who were forming little groups together to work on their finances, and that's just so encouraging because it can feel like we're doing this all alone.
Yeah, it really can, especially if you're in a community where, you know, you're the only one that's needing to focus on this. Maybe everybody else has already done this, or they're just naturally really good with money, or if you're working at a different capacity level than other people, you know, it can be really confronting to like all do a finance challenge and everyone else is saving at a much faster rate than you, like finding other people that are working with the same variables as you. That's why I think it's really important to talk about this stuff in the workplace, because you're more likely to have peers around you that are in a much more similar situation to you. You're, you know, the people that work with you in your like line of work, or under the same manager or whatever, like you're probably gonna be on very similar salary. So you're working with the same like routines and circumstances. So I think that can be really fun as well. You know, you do the same thing with fitness, like you might go for a after work Pilates class with a friend from work, like get a after work money chat at happy hour.
I think most people would want to do that. You just like slowly bring it up.
Yeah, I think that there's this weird taboo, particularly with the younger, not so much the younger generation, but when you are younger in any generation, that if you're the one that like brings up wanting to save money, you're boring. But I think it's like rebranding it and being like, this is what cool people do this. Like, getting good with money is cool.
This is how we're going to afford that holiday.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like, making it something bigger. Like, no one wants to be like the killjoy that's like, sorry, guys, can't come for dinner tonight. But if you get people involved on a much bigger level and be like, actually, I just went through my transactions and we spent like $400 on going out last month. If we don't do that for 3 months, we can go to Europe at summer. I mean, that's 2016 prices, but you know what I mean. Like,
but most people, like good people in your life, want you to succeed. Yeah. So if you get them involved and feel like, I really want to save $5,000 over the next 2 years because I want to go on this adventure. If you get them involved and they'll understand and they'll support you, and maybe you just do a dinner at home instead of going out, and then they can sort of support you during the saving up process and also be excited when you go on the trip because they've been part of the journey.
Yeah. I think it can just sometimes be a clash, particularly in like friendship circles, if your desire to make a positive change is confronting to somebody that is not ready to change. Like in the trans-theoretical model of behavior change, you look at people's readiness to change, and people will not change until they are ready. And there's a big period of time beforehand where they're not ready to change. And so they'll actually be very resistant to the change. So I think if you're, you know, it assumes that you all need some sort of change, but say, you know, you're all being young and fun and not managing your money, and eventually you will want to get better at it. I think that's the only time it can cause, that's an important time it can cause friction, because if you are more ready for change than someone else. But I mean, yeah, you choose who you share your information with, I suppose. And yeah, if people don't want the best for you, then maybe that's a red flag. I don't know.
Yeah. And that could be the time where it's slowly, you want to add a few more people to your friendship group that are maybe more interested in this particular direction you want to head in.
Yeah.
Like if you want to get fit, if you start being friends and going to running group and doing all that sort of stuff, it makes it a lot easier to get motivated because there's other people that are doing it and walking the walk.
Yeah.
Totally. Or running the run.
Running the run.
That was really bad. All right.
F45.
You mentioned money regrets before, and I was reading an article you wrote last year about your money regrets. Mm. And one of them you talked about, which was quite interesting, was being too generous with money. Now, people don't usually talk about that. Most people are like, they're not a very generous person. Mm. It's rarely you get too generous.
I'd kind of forgotten about this point in my life, but I kind of became aware of it when I was doing a lot of my financial psychology studies and kind of looking back at the key, I guess, financial flashpoints in my life. And something I remember is that I was always the one, my family had a low income, or my mum was a single mum, I got this like maintenance payment basically from college kind of thing when you're like 18, 17, 18. It's meant to be for like the cost of books, but books don't cost that much. It was like £20 or £30 a week.
Okay.
Which is quite good.
Yeah.
What I didn't really get about life, though, was that while other people's parents who weren't eligible for it weren't literally giving them the £20 a week to spend at the local shop on food for everyone, their parents had the capacity to buy them things like textbooks or to buy them things like driving lessons or those other things. So I think that I should have probably been using it for things like that. But I was always like, well, I've got more, because I also worked. So I was like, well, I've got more disposable income than you guys. So like, I'll shout everybody the round of potato wedges. And nobody really said it. I mean, of course, you're going to be like, yeah, sweet. Because there was a lot of like friction in school about like who got this payment and who didn't. And like, yeah, all the rich kids whinging about it. Well, rich kids. You know, people that weren't eligible for it were like whinging about it and stuff. And so, yeah, I was quite generous and I always worked a lot of hours. So I had disposable income at that time because, you know, I had my student loan that was covering like my, by the time I went to uni, I had my student loan that was like covering some of my rent and stuff like that. And I just kept picking up more shifts whenever I wanted more money. And so I would shout things for other people because I was like, well, I physically have money here now. But I wasn't aware of the opportunities that I could get for myself that other people would get naturally because their family might be able to support them. I didn't understand that I could use that money for other things. I was like, well, I have it now, so I'll spend it now. And that definitely
set me back. How did you shift out of that into thinking, well, I want to be a generous person. I want to be able to give money to charity and shout my friends coffee, but I also want to look after my own financial future as well.
In all honesty, I haven't flipped it back to generosity yet. Well, I have in, I guess, a charity sense. I'll often give a lot to like mutual aid funds for Aboriginal communities. There's like a few people that I follow that will post, you know, they're not like official charities, obviously, because they're literally passing the money right on. So I'll do it in that sense. But with friends and stuff, I didn't realize at the time it was a problem in enough time to stop doing it. And then I went into like full-time work where I was on a very low income, so I didn't have really the capacity to do it. And then I moved overseas and I had like different friendship circles and things like that. It's just sort of something I phased out through necessity and also gradually starting to understand how behind I was financially. But it's not something... I was actually writing an article about this the other day about like should friends shout each other dinner and things like that, or if there's a one with a higher income or a lower income, like should that be split in a different way than 50-50? It's a really complex one, I think, in the challenges of like the economy that we're in and the work environment that we're in, where like not a lot of people have loads and loads of surplus. It's not, I would like to be more generous in that way, but I haven't quite worked out how it coexists yet. But it is something, particularly after writing the article, I would like to do more of, because I feel like we're getting increasingly individualistic when it comes to money. And I think there's more room for, as like our financial capacity grows, I feel like there's more room for giving in a peer-to-peer sense. I think it's very obvious that you want to give to causes and things like that. But it's difficult because some people find it, you know, does it only work if it's reciprocated? Because some people don't want to be shouted something by someone else. But then even that is a bit weird because that's very individualistic to be like, no, I'll make my own way. Like,
I
don't know.
It's an interesting conversation to have with your friends, isn't it?
I think it's a really interesting conversation, like across the board, even thinking about that, you know, no thank you to the help. I remember when I first moved to Australia, my husband was working at... I won't say the company, but a job where his dad had also, he either did work there or was working there. And I found it really hard to get work because I was on a working holiday visa, couldn't get work anywhere. And he said to me, I can probably get you a job at this place. Looking back, I'm thinking, why didn't you take it? It was good. It was like $26 an hour. It was good money, especially coming from the UK when I was earning like $12 an hour. And I was like, no, I don't want the help. Like, I want to do this on my own. Yeah. And it's a very strange... I don't know, it kind of blurs the line of like, no, I'm going to, you know, but it's super individualistic. Like, why shouldn't we help one another on that peer-to-peer level, whether it's shouting them dinner or being generous with your surplus of income, or whether it's like helping people into a career? Because you do it as you get further on in your career. Like, if you know somebody that could get you in somewhere you want to work, like, obviously you're going to do that, but it's that weird thing when it's like the power imbalance is different. Like, I don't want that leg up. I want to get there on my own, that like dream of being self-made or whatever. I don't know. So I think it's an interesting conversation of when you're of generosity and when to accept it.
And what element of community do you want in your life?
Yeah. And how does it work if it's not equal? Like, does the generosity have a function if everybody has the same capacity? But then also, if everybody doesn't have the same capacity, when is it inappropriate? Like, when does expectation come into it? Nobody's ever going to go into it going, yeah, I expect you to pay. But if every time you go out with a friend, they pay, natural repetition, you're going to be like, well, they're paying this time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a weird one.
Yeah. A different one to think about. I don't think we have answers, but
it's an unanswerable question.
It's an interesting one to explore. And switching gears a little bit, if we're thinking about what we're working towards with our finances this year, and maybe it's being good with money, maybe it's making our first investment, maybe it's making our second investment or getting out of debt. A lot of us think about goals and New Year's resolutions, end of December, start of January. I mean, you can do them at any point in the year. What are some ideas for people, based off all your research you've done, that want to work on their finances in some capacity this year?
Well, I'll actually share something that I'm personally doing this year as well. I have made a promise to myself to do a proper, strategic, multifaceted monthly check-in. So, I mean, I'm being self-employed, I'm regularly checking in with like my finances and I kind of know what's going on. And I'll do like a big review at the end of the year, but I'm trying to do, in various different elements, much more of a monthly like reset, and then what is the focus for the new year based on where I'm at. Like, for example, we're at the end of Jan. I've spent the first 2 weeks sick, exactly the same as last year, which is really annoying. But it's already tempting to be like, oh, well, I'm behind on those goals now. But actually, if we flip that into be like, well, that's just what's going into this review, and then how am I going to adjust those for Feb and for March and onwards? Because I think the first 3-4 months of the year, you're still pretty compass in terms of what you promised to do at the start of the year. By August, you're like, I don't even remember.
It's a whole,
to be honest,
new year by that point.
Especially if you end up having like a bit of a tumultuous year, it's so easy to just throw it out the window. Whereas if you make that commitment to yourself to continuously check in and then tweak and redeploy, whether it's in literally a financial sense or in a goals sense or whatever. I'm really trying to do that because, especially being self-employed, where I've also got to think about where I earn money, I'll go into the year being like, yeah, you know, this is the year that I'm going to do this. And then I might have a couple of bad months and kind of go, oh, and suddenly that drive has dried up. Whereas it's almost like you need to sort of refill the cup at the start of every month, and so that you can have, like, everybody knows that buzzy feeling in January.
Yeah, you've got a lot of energy because you've just had 2 weeks off. Do you think you can do anything?
And your brain's got that clean break that you're seeing the year, like romanticizing this year you're going to have, and you're like picturing the TikTok you're going to make at the end and all this stuff. You can just see it now, the end of year achievements. But it's just natural for that to dry up. Whereas if you make a conscious choice to carry that cup of water, that cup of motivation all the way through, and punctuate it monthly instead, or even quarterly, but even that's quite a long time, I think it helps you stay the course for something that, you know, majority of us will get thrown off course by something or other, whether it's getting a cold for 2 weeks or it's something much bigger than that.
So for you, if you set yourself a financial goal, you'd be setting the big thing you want to achieve at the start of the year, but then every month you're thinking about, well, what am I going to do for the next 30 days to work towards that? Is that how you approach it?
Sort of, though I won't do, because I don't have a static income, I won't do a big outcome-based goal. I've tried it before with income-based goals, but in business, it's kind of, you know, you can make the income, but if the profit's not there, it's irrelevant. I also find they're a bit too big for me, and it's not always clear, especially when you've got to be a bit sort of serendipitous with what's happening. I will more do sort of like much bigger thematic goals, or have like a word. So my word this year is mastery in various, I know how that kind of works in various areas of my life and my business. So at the monthly check-in, I'm sort of like looking at these areas and thinking, okay, you know, what areas of mastery have been achieved here? What have I done to try and get closer to that? What are the different circumstances? And then deploy that into the next month and with an income or a savings goal, for example, it's much more around, okay, so what I'm trying to get myself better at, like, cause and effect. So, like, what did I make that month? Okay, well, what did I do? Because it's not, I don't know, I think it's a difficult thing when you do like a multi-hyphenate type of job where your income is coming from different areas, which at times can be really abundant and then at other times can be really scarce. Sort of trying to pattern recognition and seeing how pulling different levers can get me kind of like working smarter rather than working harder. When I had a big outcome-based goal, I would just constantly keep like trying and trying and trying, whereas choosing to master something instead and actually not only get the outcome but work out how I got to the outcome so that I can replicate it in like an sort of an employee or a much more everyday sense where that income is guaranteed. I would sort of, this is almost where the snowball spending comes in, because you can actually look at, okay, I saved heaps that month. What did I do? I found it really easy this month. What's the data there? Yeah. How can I deploy that into the next month? So it's much more of like a commitment to being able to replicate your success rather than going balls to the wall and saving $5,000 and then going, well, now what? Because that can happen.
Yeah.
You actually know how you did that, why you did that, and now you can save 10 or 20.
What about picking yourself up after setbacks? Because a lot of us will go, oh, we want to save $1,000 this month, and then life happens and that unexpected rojo comes through and suddenly we didn't progress towards our goal at all this month. Maybe we went backwards and it feels like, oh, is there any point still sticking with it, because I'm not going to hit that goal I set.
I actually have a section in the book about financial resilience, which I will find for you. Obviously, I talk about having the practical resilience in terms of having money for emergencies, but there's also an element of mental resilience, which comes from the field of financial psychology. So it talks a lot about the concept of learned optimism and how, without dancing towards toxic positivity, how learned optimism can help you come back from those setbacks. And it talks about these three P's: permanence, pervasiveness, and personalization. So permanence refers to the duration we associate with an incident of adversity. Pervasiveness refers to the way we ascribe either specific or universal effects and meanings to such an incident. And then personalization refers to our attribution of cause or blame for the incident, either to internal or external factors. So the thinking is, if you can think of those three P's, when you try and save $1,000, you're, you know, denied a pay rise and you get your rego and also you got a flat tire and a parking ticket. When we think of those three P's, how much am I blaming myself for this? How universal or specific am I making this? Am I making this mean something about all of my savings capacity going forward? Am I making this mean something about myself going forward? And also, how permanent is this? Like, those are actually isolated events. They have no bearing on your future financial outcomes, but they do have a bearing on you. So if they get to you, your behavior is going to be less conducive to the financial outcomes you want because you're making them a much more permanent issue. Whereas when you can actually get used to, and a lot of it's around the language and, you know, that you, it's not about not being frustrated by those things, but it's about recognizing when you're saying things like, oh, well, I've just stuffed it now, or I'll just start again next month, or I can't do it then, or it's just so hard. And these are things that I, especially being self-employed, I catch myself with often. I'll have like a sponsored campaign lined up and it'll get cancelled, and suddenly I'm making grand claims about how my industry is dead. And there's that pervasiveness thing and the permanence. Like, it's not, that's not what it's about. It's almost about stepping back and seeing those incidences of being thrown off course for what they are and not making them mean something else that not only makes you feel worse, but actually informs your behaviour. That's going to be the that's going to be the thing that throws you off. If you get a flat tire, it bears no implication on what you're going to do next month, unless you tell yourself that it means that you can't save any money. Then you're going to go out and spend all your money right up to that capacity because that's what you believe to be true.
It's so easy to extrapolate one failure or mistake and say, well, if I failed that, I must just be a failure at all of this related stuff, even though it has nothing to do with each thing.
And it's what your brain wants to do at that time to absolve that anxiety and to feel like you're in control. You're trying to make sense of the situation, and the easiest thing to do is to just apply that universal rule of, that's the way it is and this is how I understand it, and now I can move on.
Yep.
Whereas, if you think of those three P's and maybe read the whole chapter rather than just those three things, but thinking about how you're viewing the situation and how it might be informing future behaviour.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this now and you've already fallen behind one of the goals you set, do not wait till the 1st of January 2025. Use this month. You can choose any day this week to just reset and focus on what you're going to achieve from this point on.
Yes, everyone know that the year starts in March anyway.
I mean, January's just flown past them.
Yeah, truly.
Don't know where it's gone. Now, there is so much good stuff in Good With Money. It is a wonderful book. I hope everyone picks up a copy. It's a great one to give to a friend who's at the start of their own finance journey too. And it doesn't overlap with many of the other finance books you've read. So I think that'll be a good addition to the bookshelf. But Emma, what's the number one thing you want listeners to take away from this conversation?
The number one thing I want people to take away from this conversation is it doesn't need to be as hard as your brain might want you to think that it does. Whether it's taking small action or it's moving on from that adversity a little bit faster or even just changing the way that you're viewing that adversity, remember that your brain is actually against you a lot of the time and it takes time to master its habits in order to actually change your own outcomes.
You're not born being good with money. It's something you work on day by day. Emma, if people want to get in touch with you, if they want to grab a copy of Good With Money, where should they go?
You can go to any major bookstore, Dimmicks, Readings, Big W, etc. You can find me on Instagram at the @thebrokegeneration, also very occasionally on TikTok under the same handle, or head to thebrokegeneration.com or listen to the podcast, The Broke Generation Podcast.
Yeah, and if you want some inspo on setting some goals this year, if you haven't yet and it's something you want to do, many listeners when I put a poll up on socials the other day indicated they still wanted to set some goals this year. You have a lot of inspiration on your podcast. So Emma, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Australian Finance Podcast. We hope you learned something new and were able to take one thing away from this episode.
If you're keen to learn more, head on over to Rask Education and take one of our free money and investing courses. You could even become a Rask Core member for less than your Netflix subscription each month. And don't forget to subscribe for new episodes in your inbox every week.
Plus, if you enjoyed the show, we'd love you to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and send any questions.
SBS Audio is supported by advertising. Audio update for English learners that will expand your vocabulary and help you keep up to date.
Follow SBS Learn English and SBS News in Easy English on the SBS Audio app, website or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
Your daily 10-minute business and finance news wrap for this Tuesday, the 27th of February, 2024. On Market Day, we will speak with Matt Sherwood from Perpetual about the day's market action, including that of Coles, which today posted a $589 million half-year profit, which was down 8%. But shares did surge today as supermarket revenue climbed almost 5%. As food inflation stayed at around 3% in the half. Its CEO, Leah Weckert, spoke to the media and was asked about her views of competition in the sector, given accusations of price gouging ahead of a sector inquiry. Here's some of what she had to say.
The first thing I'd say is that profits are an essential thing for any business. They enable us to continue to operate, and for us that means we get to employ 120,000 people. We get to support thousands of suppliers. We pay a very large tax bill every year. We're in the top 100 of taxpayers in Australia. And we pay dividends out to, we've got about 440,000 direct shareholders. 80% of them own less than 2,000 shares. So they are mums and dads and families and retirees that are benefiting from those dividend payments. And of course, we have Coles shares in many, many superannuation funds. So there are millions of Australians that are also indirectly benefiting from those dividends. In terms of our profit, we make around $2.60 for every $100 a customer spends, so less than 3 cents on the dollar. And that margin has now been stable for at least the last 5 years, and it has not gone up as we have seen inflation come through. And food inflation has been faced everywhere in the world. It is a global issue. It is not unique to Australia. And you'll see in our presentation today, actually, we highlight the fact that food inflation in Australia has been lower, quite significantly lower over the last few years. compared to many other developed economies like UK, European area, US, New Zealand, etc. And that food inflation that we have seen come through, it is driven by higher input prices. That's higher cost of fertilizer, it's higher raw material costs like wheat, which really spiked when the Ukraine war started. It's higher shipping, packaging and labour costs. And that is what has flowed through and led to the inflation and higher prices going to customers. But, you know, the competition between Australian retailers I would describe as fierce, and I think that is one of the things that plays into the fact that our inflation levels here over the last few years have been lower than other economies. And when you look around the world at the competitive dynamics, I mean, one of the things that I actually think is wonderful in Australia is we have a very vibrant food retail market. If you go to a shopping centre, you can usually have the choice of 2 to 3 different supermarkets. You can usually choose from a number of independents, the bakeries, the fresh produce providers, butchers, many of the butchers, you know, there'll be ones that specialise in chicken and others that specialise in fish and others that specialise in meat. There is a huge variety in terms of what the customer has to choose from. And before the customer even leaves home, they can hop online and order from Amazon. I actually got home last night and my husband had ordered 2 things on Amazon, luckily not food items, but he did say to me, I'm getting pretty good at spending money on Amazon. And I think, you know, we underestimate by the time you add in all of the supermarkets, including 2 very significant global players in Aldi and Costco, Amazon, all of the independents, and then a wide range of retailers like Chemist Warehouse and Priceline and Bunnings that are playing in categories that we also have in the store, that is significant choice for the customer.
That's Leah Wickett there, the CEO of Coles, speaking at a media briefing today.
Now, Market Day on the SBS On The Money podcast.
Our Coles shares did respond well, up 5.5% today, leading the Australian share market, which did finish higher, but only just. The S&P ASX 200 up 0.1% to 7,663. For more on the day's market action, including Coles numbers, I spoke with Matt Sherwood, the head of investment strategy at Perpetual. Matt, can we start with Coles? Shares have really taken off today following its results. Why? And what does the whole result say about where the consumer is at the moment?
Well, the market certainly liked the result. I'm not sure it says anything too much about the consumer per se. The Australian consumer is under quite a bit of income stress at the moment, given, you know, when you combine what wages are doing, how much tax you pay, how much interest you pay, and what inflation's doing, household income growth's about -3%, -4%, and that's about a 30-year low. So I think what this really indicates is that staple retailers have got a very good track record in doing well during periods of inflation. And that's for 2 reasons. Well, first of all, they're able to pass the cost increases on, unlike a discretionary retailer who may put his prices up and then the consumer will say, oh, well, I'll get that in 6 months' time. Of course, it's very hard to do that with essentials like food. And the other reason why Coles has done particularly well, I would argue this time, is that they are exposed to the least risky part of Australia's GDP growth profile, and that is population growth. So on a revenue front, they're exposed to the huge surge we're having in population. In terms of margins, they can pass their costs on. So, you know, they're very well positioned to do well during these periods of inflation. The challenge is going to come, of course, when inflation returns to, you know, to 2 or 3%.
On the Money podcast.
It's a pretty flat day on the share market today. The S&P ASX 200 up only just by 0.1%, 7,712. For more on the day's market moves, I spoke with Scott Phillips, Chief Investment Officer at the Motley Fool.
Ricardo, thankfully a bit of stability after the biggest fall in a couple of years yesterday. Hopefully a bit of, well, not even optimism, just a lack of pessimism. We'll take that today after a tough day yesterday.
All eyes on tonight's US inflation numbers. What's expected and what's it likely to mean for the timing of the first interest rate cut in the US?
Yeah, they are such good questions. They absolutely link together, of course, because what's expected is a modest increase in monthly inflation. But because of the way these things are calculated, that will bring down the annual rate. In other words, the month we're dropping will be larger than the month we're picking up. That should hopefully continue the decline in annual inflation. Core inflation still too hot at about 3.7%, according to the experts who were polled. What we don't know is how Jerome Powell will track this data. As always, if there's no surprise in the data, if it's what the Fed Reserve expects, what commentators expect, we should see interest rates come down in the Fed's current timing. If there are expectations that are blown away in one way or the other, either too high or too low, that will, of course, throw the cat well and truly among the pigeons.
Iron ore prices fell 7% overnight. How much of that has to do with China?
Most of it, mate. This is a really big challenge for global commodity markets, for iron ore in particular, obviously, is the continued challenges out of China. Much better growth than almost anywhere else around the world, so that's a positive. The problem is nowhere near what we're used to or what the country itself expects. Now, when you break that down, the challenge for our iron ore miners in particular and for the commodity in general is that demand is seen to be waning. And if it is, lower steel production does mean a slowing down in China. So bad news for iron ore. Bad news for China more broadly, and that unfortunately means bad news for the global economy.
While iron ore is down, gold still pretty strong, and gold stocks having their best day in about a week. What's behind that?
A combination of expectations, I think, if you look at what we just talked about with the global challenges and the interest rate decisions to come, gold often seen as a hedge against both the stock market generally and inflation specifically. There does seem to be a bit of movement around. We've seen Bitcoin, of course, go through the roof. Gold having a bit of time in the sun as well. Largely that question of what do investors expect? What do they need to be prepared for? There are some concerns. See, Jamie Dimon, CEO and chair of JP Morgan Chase, out today saying possibly a 2/3 chance of a global recession. That's got people a little worried.
Can we just spend a couple of seconds on this ongoing debate about property versus shares, right? The Bureau of Statistics today showed that the total value of dwellings in Australia rose by $624 billion or 6.4%, right? Compare that with the ASX 200, it climbed more than that, 8.5% over the same period. What do you tell clients when they're deciding between property and shares?
So I'm a shares guy, so people will expect me to say shares and take that with a grain of salt because I will, not because I work for a company that picks shares, but more specifically because the local property market can only grow at the rate effectively of wages over time. We can play with interest rates, we can play with loan valuation ratios, those things kind of push things around, but at the end of the day, your ability to pay the rent or pay the mortgage is what's going to determine prices over the long term. Now, we've had a lot of different things in the past. Moving forward, that's likely to be the most, I think, most likely outcome. Now, think about shares. It's a subset of the business community. Now, if you took a subset of property and then a subset of shares or a subset of businesses, you might have a different conversation. But if property as a whole can only over time go up as fast as wages, yet this small subset, the 1,500-odd companies on the ASX, can grow their profits and have traditionally faster than the rest of the economy, I think shares are probably, over the long term, the better bet from here.
Where do you see the opportunities for investors at the moment?
Mate, I've been talking about retail for quite a while now, about 6 months, and the shares are up pretty nicely, which is always good, but I think there's still some opportunity left there. If you look at some of the price earnings ratio, some of the valuations of some of our more higher quality, stable, long-term success retailers, think about Harvey Norman, JB Hi-Fi, plenty of others besides, they're on higher PEs than they were 6 months ago, but still really low relative to the long-term future. I would suspect there's still some value left there.
Scott Phillips there from The Motley Fool.
Well, that it. It was quick, Hector? Anyway, we think that our finances are really good. I don't see no problem, but sometimes when you do take a little bit out or spend the money on something or whatever it is, it doesn't accumulate or something, and it goes down. You know what I mean? If you're in the market or you're not in the market or whatever, You want to come from the Philippines to Australia. You want to come from Germany to Australia. You want to do a family business where you are who you are and trying to be someone special or something. Family matters, always talking about cooking because you're going to buy food. You want to talk about buying a computer, doing your best and whatever it is. It's interested that you are the champion. You are who you are and what you are and where you are at. So beautifully, you didn't get the award, you didn't get the final finish, but what you got is a place to live and beautiful people around, and it was fantastic. I love you, I love you. I'm in the mix sector, El Chileno. Hallelujah. On the name of God, on the name of God, on the name of God. Thank you, I'm in the mix sector. Subscribe.